You can go ahead and take your seat if you're going to sit here for the next case. Morning, Council. Welcome. As you get situated, I want to remind you that the microphone and the podium moves up and down, so if you would make sure that you're speaking into the microphone when it's your turn and also state your name before you begin. Are you ready to proceed, Council?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lucas Dawson, and I represent the appellant mother in this case. So as the court's aware, based on the briefs in this case, we're here on the basis of a termination of parental rights. And as I was preparing for this case and actually having discussions with counsel, we had a lot of conversations about kind of where we're at and why we're here, essentially. And so, at least from the appellant's perspective, as I was reviewing this case, I was finding it incredibly important to focus on the order itself and really why we're here. So this case is really unique in that the parties had agreed down at the district court level to a stay of adjudication. And I can start off by understanding and knowing that those are disfavored. And I can tell that there was a lot of conversation that went around with that. However, what happened, though, when we got done with the trial, when we received the court's final order, and looking at the standard of review, I would note for the court that the district court did make the findings are not supported by the evidence, and in fact, in the conclusions of law, the district court abused its discretion. As I was preparing and in discussions, the word presumption has continually come up, both throughout the respondent's brief as well as in the court's order. And I really wanted to start off by perhaps clarifying, because in juvenile court, there are certain areas where there are presumptions and there are certain areas where there are not.
So I assume what you're talking about is the presumption that the district court refers to, which really seems to be going to subdivision 1B5.
Correct.
Versus 1B4, which
Correct.
Is the issue here.
Yes, and that's the issue here, and I believe even counsel touched on that in her brief, and we're going to respectfully disagree on where each of us stand at that one. But I note for the court, as I'm looking specifically at the conclusions of law, starting in page 24 of the court's order, starting on paragraph 13, the district court really starts talking about a presumption. Now, what's interesting here is the district court's technically citing the presumption that was, or the statute that was used in this case when you look at the March 22nd order. However, the district court is referencing when there has been a prior termination of parental rights. And in prior terminations of parental rights, there is a presumption. There is a presumption that the parent then has to overcome.
Right, but here we only have the statutory factor. We don't have the reasonable efforts or the best interest determinations made by the district court in the prior one,
Correct.
Which is different than what happened in the 2001 case that you're referring to, where by the Minnesota Supreme Court is what I assume you're referring
yes,
to.
Yes, exactly. In the PRL case, they're looking at a different statute.
Right.
And so that in of itself, there are presumptions located within that statute. That's not what we're talking about here. That was not the statutory basis that the court found here. And then in the district court's order, though, the district court seems to be confusing really what the law is and what that presumption is. And what's most concerning is that even when we're looking at paragraph 13 down at the bottom, the district court actually says, and again, it's citing the RDL case, and the RDL case is a prior termination.
Right. And if I might cut to the chase here, because I understand where you're going on this issue, but I think if you look at paragraphs 13, 14, 15, they do talk about the rebuttable presumption, but paragraph 16 does not reference the rebuttable presumption at all and seems to be a standalone statement by the district court that mother has failed to demonstrate her ability to successfully parent the child. In other words, there's a reason why mother is palpably unfit under subdivision 1B4.
And I see where you're going, and the problem that I had when you read the order is that then it's trying to parse out one paragraph when the entire preceding paragraphs to that are citing the exact wrong standard. And even when the district court is saying in paragraph 13 that this seems to be even a lesser standard than clear and convincing evidence. It's as if the district court is reading it through that lens, and that's a problem. That is an abuse of discretion because this is clear and convincing evidence. There was no presumption. And then when we take it even further and the district court is looking at, is she palpably unfit? My client's admission was very specific in the March 22nd order. And in fact, that admission, which relates to some of the due process argument, but I think where I really was focusing is that her admission really relates to her medication. That's what the original termination of parental rights petition even focused on specifically. And so when we look at that.
But her admission is that, I mean, she admitted to being unfit.
She did admit to being unfit.
So what impact does her admission have on the, it, let's assume for the moment that the district court did apply a rebuttable presumption. Does it even matter if she herself admitted that she was unfit?
Well, first of all, it's error that the district court applied a rebuttable presumption. That in and of itself is error. And then that creates a concern as to what all the other decisions that flowed from that. And then when we look at the fact that, yes, she made an admission that she was palpably unfit, but we have to look at that factual basis for that admission. And the factual basis for that admission was that if she is not taking her medications, that then that creates that palpable unfitness. And in fact, in the district court's order on March 22nd, the district court specifically found that she was complying. And in fact, all parties even agreed at trial that she was taking her medication. And then that gets to the issue of the stay or the revocation of the stay, which is that in order to revoke the stay, the district court had to not only two things the district court had to determine. The district court had to determine, was there the basis at the time of trial, which the district court actually says she is taking her medication. She's following through, and what's concerning is that there were these sort of allegations that maybe she was not mentally fit at that point, with no calls to her psychiatrist, no calls to her therapist, no calls to her ARMS worker, no calls to the public health nurse she's working for. Essentially, nobody actually verified any of that, which is concerning in and of itself. But then we all agree that she was, in fact, taking her medication, and, in fact, evidence was provided as part of that trial. I believe it's Exhibits 102 to 105, if I remember correctly. She provided proof through blood tests that she was, in fact, taking her medication as far back as, and I don't have it in front of me, I apologize, but I believe it was June of 2018. Well before we ever even entered into the stay. And so when you get to that, so from our position, the district court had to make both those determinations. Was, and I believe that's supported by law, was there, at the time of the revocation, was there sufficient basis to terminate her parental rights as palpably unfit? Based on her admission, no, there was not. Then when you get to the secondary, and quite frankly, if it fails on that one, then it fails altogether.
You have to help me out with that, counsel. I feel like you skipped a step.
Okay.
And maybe I just missed it. So if
no,
you
that's,
go
please.
More slowly, I'll get it. So I understand that you're saying to revoke the stay, that to uphold a revocation of the stay, that this court would have to find that the initial the admission of palpable unfitness could be upheld.
Correct.
Right? But what I'm not clear is why the stay itself could be revoked for failure to comply with conditions.
Well, and I think that's where you have to look at the case law that flows from this, the BJB, the PR, BJB, I believe, PRL and DF. I mean, they all talk about how you have to have both of these because you cannot just have, and I believe it's PRL that actually, while I realize it's a different subdivision of the statute, at least does talk about how the district court at the time of the termination still has to have those grounds to terminate. It's not just did the parent violate the conditions of the stay. And then in this...
But the determination, and it's mother's admission that she's palpably unfit.
Correct.
Based on her failure to take medication and the impact of her mental health on her child, all right?
Correct.
That, I think, is a fair paraphrase of what she admitted to. So that...
And, to be specific, yeah. She does, her admission is that when she's failing to take her medication, that impacts her child. And so it's not just that her mental health impacts her child. It's that when she's failing to take her medication, that in and of itself impacts her ability to care for her child.
Counsel, I beg to differ a little bit there, because on the finding in that when the TPR was stayed, the district court said one basis for the reunification was mother's compliance with her mental health needs, including medication. And so while the focus is indeed on her taking her medication and here and the fact that she didn't and she needs to make sure that she gets on her medication, I didn't read it as being that being the only basis. That alone, I don't think, is enough. What you need to have under the statute is a consistent pattern of specific conduct before the child or of specific conditions directly relating to the parent-child relationship. So if I'm understanding Judge Bradfold's question, I think the bigger picture issue is the lack of her ability to be to attend to the child's emotional and mental needs. I think this is really just being used as an example of, you agree you're, at this time you are palpably unfit, and one of the things that you're not doing is you're not attending to your mental health needs.
Except that as I'm looking at, so including taking her medication and in complying with her mental health needs, and I think, but when we look at that, then even if you look at the conditions of the stay, it's that she's following through on her psychiatry, she's following through with her therapist, she's going to meet with the child's therapist to understand that from the child's perspective. And in fact, the court's own findings, when we look at under the findings of fact, the court actually makes those findings that she is doing that. I apologize, I was trying to get there. But it is starting at page 14 of the court's order, paragraph 70, and it goes on down about how paragraph 72, mother has attended all psychiatry appointments, mother is compliant, she's met with the psychiatrist, she's attending individual therapy, it goes on and on about all the things that she is doing. And then essentially this case turns on the meeting on July 26th, which I apologize. I don't know if that's where you were going when I had jumped in.
No,
so I apologize.
Go ahead.
So Ms. Dawson, what is it that the court stayed?
What did the court stay? The court stayed the termination of parental rights.
The decision to terminate.
The adjudication, yes.
And is it your position that if a court were to do that, based on an admission of unfitness from a party, that they cannot revoke that stay unless you have another trial on unfitness 6 months later or 3 months later or 100, however many days later when the revocation occurs? You have to have a new trial on unfitness, that the admission isn't enough?
If the basis for the admission no longer exists, and I think that's what you look at even in termination of parental rights cases, and that's the clear law, the basis has to exist at the time of trial.
Is there any law or any examples where the condition that was violated was different than or somehow separate from unfitness? Because that to me would be the apples to apples comparison.
Well,
if you had a condition that wasn't related to the statutory basis that was violated, potentially in that case, maybe I'm agreeing with you that you would have to have a new trial at that point. But
when I looked at the case law, what I was finding, and I had brought some of them with, but so PRL, there was the significant domestic abuse history. She was still with her abuser. When we look at BJB, the parents were chemically dependent and continue to remain chemically dependent. When we look at, I believe the other one that I'd cited, I believe it was DF, we still had the continuation of the use of chemicals.
But is there a case that says it has to? Where's the case that says you cannot condition or revoke someone for violating a condition that's unrelated?
Well, then you get into the due process argument, because then where's the notice? So in this case, and they're entitled to notice. They're entitled to notice of what the allegations are against them.
Right,
that is why we have a petition.
If they've already entered an admission, then your due process is related to notice of the conditions that you violated. If the condition were go to therapy, if the condition were you have to show up at a certain place at a certain time every Monday, and that isn't necessarily directed or related to the statutory basis, where's the law that says that there's a due process problem if that's the condition that she's made aware of at the time she enters into her admission
And I think what the answer is, at least based on all the research that we've done, is that there is no case where the statutory basis was still not in existence. This essentially is a novel. This is a sort of a first impression, if you will. Because when you look at the case law that has come before this case, those conditions were still existing. The parents were still testing positive for chemicals. They were not engaging in their therapy. They were not doing what was there. And so, unfortunately, the palpable unfitness factual basis, was still existing at the time of the termination.
So if this is a novel case or new, the rule of law that you'd be asking us to impose is something along the lines of, if you're going to stay adjudication in a TPR based on an admission, then you have to make the statutory basis a condition of the stay.
I'm not following. I'm sorry.
So I guess I'm asking you, without putting words in your mouth, what is the new rule that you'd like us to impose here in terms of what conditions are appropriate when you're going to stay termination? Is the new rule that the condition of the stay is that the statutory basis is still present?
Well, no, because then that would defeat the purpose of the stay. I mean,
what's the rule you're asking us to impose?
Well, in this case, and maybe it's... Oh, and I just ran out of time. If you'd like, I can...
I think it's okay. And maybe... Or maybe why don't we do this? Why don't you save, and you can think about that, and you have your five-minute rebuttal.
Sounds good. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Catherine Tim from the county, the Anoka County Attorney's Office on behalf of the respondent, Anoka County Social Services. I think I'm going to hit the due process argument first and then kind of go backwards. And I'd like to actually focus on the last set of questions that were coming from the panel regarding the statutory basis. And one of the things that I found really tricky and confusing about this case as I was going through it is that there's a lot of talk back and forth about statutory basis or statutory grounds and factual basis, and they seem to be getting confused. And it is the county's position that we have a statutory basis, which is palpable unfitness. We have factual basis, which is that she admitted very, very tight facts about using her meds and being medically compliant for her mental health purposes. But the grounds or the conditions of the stay were far broader than that, and that those...
Is that the error that you identify, or is that the error you think they are identifying, that the conditions of the stay are too broad because they're not confined to...
Well, I don't think it's too broad. I don't think it is an error. I think that the conditions of the stay actually addressed all of the statute of palpable unfitness. And that's the reason for that. It's not just that the mother in this case was palpably unfit when she wasn't taking her meds. The statute talks about, you know, someone who is essentially unable to parent. That's what palpable unfitness is really all about. And unfortunately, I think there was a great deal of hope that this mother, if she took her medication, that she could parent. But the fact of the matter is, she just isn't capable of parenting. And that is whether she's on her medication or not on her medication. And that was something that I think was unknown.
So did the mother have noticed that that would be the position that the county was going to take at the evidentiary hearing? That's what I hear is the due process argument.
Right.
Because as you said, the mother's admission was fairly narrow. I agree with you. It's not just compliance with taking medications. It's medical compliance. So it's full compliance with the recommendations of
right.
her medical care for
right.
her mental health.
That's her admission. But
that was
statute,
her admission. But
the
as you said,
talks about more than
the
that.
Judge, and I just grabbed one of them. There are several places in the judge's findings after the evidentiary hearing, the second one, the revocation hearing, on 845, where the addendum 45, where the judge is pretty clear that despite taking her medications, attending the appointments, working with mental health workers, going to therapy, and all other required services, so the judge is basically saying, I am finding that mother is doing all of these things. Mother is still unable to control her mental health outbursts in front of the child and does not understand how her outbursts impact the child. And I think that's echoed several times in the judge's order.
Right.
So did the mother have noticed that that's what the issue was going to be and that was going to be the basis for the termination?
I think she certainly did. Certainly at the time that the notice of motion and motion were filed, accompanied by an 11-page court report from the social worker, there was full notice as to what was going to be argued. And in addition to that, the conditions of the stay were adopted at that March 22nd hearing in front of Judge Shuffleman and were attached to the May 15th order from that hearing of Judge Shuffleman. And it set out all of the things.
I agree. I mean, I don't see a problem with notice of the conditions. They're
right.
pretty clear and explicit. And I don't even hear an argument that the conditions are unclear.
And
it's the basis for termination that is ultimately found after the stay is lifted. That's the issue.
And those conditions were included things beyond just going to appointments and doing those, that she had to actually learn about what her child's needs were, that she actually had to be cooperative with service providers, even if they said things that she didn't want to hear. And that's where we get into the problems. And that's very clear from the orders about the stay, the hearing where the stay was adopted, and she indicated that she understood that. And she understood that if she violated any conditions of the stay, that her rights could be terminated. It was very, very clear. So, yes, she had notice of that going back to March, going back to May. And then when we get to July, on July 31st, where the county makes the motion and provides an 11-page document accompanied by exhibits in addition to that, where it's all set out, it's very clear what that notice is going to be and what the county is basing that motion to revoke the stay on. I don't think that there is a due process argument I don't find the due process argument is sustainable from the appellant's point of view based on the case law. If you look at DF, where it specifically says you're entitled to notice, you're entitled to a timely hearing, a reasonable opportunity to be heard, representation, all of those things. All of those things were here. It's not something that requires a new petition. And to also indicate that there had never been a claim that the kinds of behaviors that were displayed by the mother at that July 26th parent meeting wouldn't have been or had never been raised before, that's not true. In the original petition, very similar behaviors were the basis of the original TPR petition here. And going back, those were the same behaviors that were noticed in the first CHIPS case in this matter. That's been a continuing concern, that this mother focuses on things that don't have to do with her child's well-being.
Supporting you, the judge does make some determinations about a pattern.
Right, and it's a pattern of conduct.
So I want to make sure that you have some time to address the statutory presumption of palpable unfitness that the district court references on page 43, or at least our addendum, page 43. And I'll point out a couple of spots very specifically that I'd like you to make sure I understand how you think the judge did not make an error or didn't make an error that's prejudicial. So the judge says, you know, first references the statutory presumption. We've already talked about that somewhat. Tell us whatever you would like about the conclusion of Law 13. But then in 14, the judge says, to rebut the presumption, a parent must show more than engagement in services. A parent must demonstrate his or her ability to successfully parent a child, which I think is a reflection. It's an accurate statement of law. It's a reflection that when this presumption is applied, the burden of proof does shift, right, to the parent. To some extent, at least to rebut the presumption.
In the 1B4 presumption, which I am not arguing is present here.
Yeah, and I understand that. Yeah. My real question is, did it affect the judge's decision that there is this discussion about palpable unfitness? So in paragraph 16, the judge uses this language, which just seems to echo what was written in 14. So mother has, I skipped the first sentence, but going to the second one, mother has failed to demonstrate her ability to successfully parent the child. It sounds like the judge is pushing that burden of proof onto the mother.
It does sound like that, and I will admit that the first time I read this order, it gave me pause. Okay. And then I went and I looked at PRL, and that gave me pause as well, because I think it's unfortunate that this case, the statute that the admission was to was palpable unfitness. It would have been, and in the original TPR petition, there were five grounds. I think it would be clearer if the admission had been to one of the other four.
Like 1B2.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I don't read it, and the state, the county's position was never that the B4 palpable unfitness presumption applied. And it wasn't tried like that at the evidentiary hearing, and that's not my argument. And I actually don't think that if you look at the hearing that the judge needed to go there. I think that there is enough evidence here to support that we proved palpable unfitness at the hearing, and we did. Her continuing behaviors, her continuing conduct, her continuing assumption that what is good for her is good for her child, and her failure to understand her child's developmental needs, that is what makes her palpably unfit, and it continues all the way through.
So is your argument then that at the March stay hearing that the reason or reasons that the district court cited, it's not complete, and kind of looking at the big picture, that the fact is that she admitted that she, at that time, was palpably unfit.
I think that's a different question than what I'm trying to answer for Judge Breville, but let me get there as well. I think that the factual basis that she laid for the statutory ground of palpable unfitness was very narrow, and woulda, coulda, shouldas, I wish that Judge Stoffelman would have asked for a little bit more. But there's never been a challenge by anybody to go back and correct that record, so we have what we have.
So is that really then the basis for the TPR determination later then? Or is it new information?
I think there's new information. And I think, and this gets me back to Judge Bradfield's question, is that you've got that finding that you have to deal with, that Judge McCarthy comes in and is has this finding that's there from Judge Shuffleman, but then she also hears additional evidence. And the additional evidence, and it's throughout her findings of fact, starting at about finding page 17 of her order, and finding of fact 100, and going on through at least 124, where you've got various times that the court finds that based on what she's seeing is that parenting is a stressor at 102. Parenting is a stressor for mother. It takes away from her ability to care for her own mental health. Her mental health takes away from being able to care for the child's needs. She can provide for physical needs, but she can't provide for the emotional support, the nutrients that this child needs. And that goes on, and that she lacks the ability to know when to implement the safety plans and all the things that she's tried to put together.
So I hate to circle back, but if that's the case, if it's based on new evidence, then is the 11-page document that had been filed with the new TPR request to revoke the stay, was that sufficient to put mother on notice of the new additional facts that are going to be the basis for the finding of palpable unfitness?
Yes. And in addition, I think there will always be new facts. Whenever you have a revocation of a stay, of course there will be, because there's something that caused the stay to be revoked. And I'm sorry, I'm seeing my time is up.
Finish. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, that's always going to be the case. There's always going to be a new fact because you have to have something that revoked the stay. And you have to show two things. You have to show not only that the revocation has occurred or that the conditions have been violated, but you also have to show that the underlying statutory basis is still continuing. And that's going to be new facts. It's always going to be new facts. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Now, I know prior to sitting down, Judge Bryan, you had asked about what is the rule? What would be the new, if there is a new rule, what would it be? And my argument is I'm not asking the court to make a new rule of law. And I would point the court specifically to the DF case. And it's on page 94. Where the Court of Appeals says, therefore, when considering a motion to revoke a stay, the district court must not only determine whether the statutory, and I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, whether the statutory ground exists, it must also address the parent's compliance with the conditions. Now, in this case, we've talked a lot about what the admission was that mother had made. I also wanted to highlight for the court, it was part of the addendum to the respondent's brief, was the original TPR petition. And I think that's also instructive as to how we got to mother's admission. And that paragraph 12 of that, literally, it does say, in order to safely and effectively parent her child, mother needs to consistently take her medication as prescribed and attend all her medical appointments, even when ACCP is not providing guidance or support. And then I'm going to kind of move on a little bit here. ACCP is concerned that this pattern would continue and be repeated. They're focused specifically on mother taking her medication and following through on that. That's the basis for the original TPR petition. That's the basis for the admission. Essentially, not much had changed. Now, I know counsel was talking some about that essentially that factual basis and new information can come through. Quite frankly, that is sort of a scary thought that the rule could become, as your case is progressing on a revocation of a stay, that essentially now what that basis for the admission was as to why the parties entered into the agreement can essentially now be shifted. I think the question more goes to whether, the question then goes to whether she had actually violated the conditions of the stay.
Well, I think those are two different issues. One is whether or not she violated the conditions of the stay. The second is whether or not there's a basis and a continuing basis for the finding that she is palpably unfit. And right. And I think when you look at the fact that in the first TPR, there was a determination and an admission that she was unable to parent. And that seems to be really the key issue here. Was she unable to parent originally? Yes, everybody agreed she was unable to, but everybody said, let's give her another opportunity. When she violated the conditions, there had to be a violation of the conditions, but then also a determination that she still is unable to parent. And the district court said, yes, she's still unable to parent, despite all the tremendous progress that she is making, which is very, very commendable. I mean, she's made, unlike a lot of the other cases, she's making great progress in terms of her mental health, in terms of her medications, in terms of her you know, she's developing a plan, actually a couple different plans. But the key thing in my mind seems to be, is she able to parent? And that's really where I'm struggling to see where she's able to identify the needs of the child through not only the incident at the center, but also even in her home. So,
well, and I think I have sort of two responses to that. One, she admitted that she was unable to parent when she's not taking her medications and when she's not complying with her mental health needs. And two, I think the other response to that is, again, then when it gets to this concern of whether the district court was really using clear and convincing evidence based on those conclusions of law that I talked about way early on in my argument. But in additionally, then, I think that also goes to, I believe it's the MDO case, where we're not looking for perfect parenting. Our model parenting, I believe, is actually what that case says. And so when we look at that, then, even when you look at the district court's order, and I know I've already mentioned this in the findings of fact, the district court goes on and on about all of the needs of her child that she is meeting. She does not have to be perfect. There's no concerns of physical abuse. There's no concerns of chemical abuse. She has a home. She's taking the child to her medical appointments. She's seeking medical care for the child. There seems to be this question of whether she would continue therapy, except I always found that to be somewhat extremely speculative, as she had continued in therapy for years herself. And so she was meeting her child's need, and the district court actually made those findings and then focus specifically on the July 26th incident. And again, I think even if you go back to then, even the guardian noted in her testimony that every parent has bad days. We all have our bad days, but we don't have our rights terminated based on a bad day. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory deadline.